Taiwan criticizes the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal for their failure to act on the U.S. violations of the accord. Votes are being counted in Iraq for the Sunday early parliamentary elections. Officials put the voter turnout at 41%. Tunisian president approves a new government to end weeks of tensions sparked by his decision to fire the previous prime minister and suspend parliament. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafi. Good to have you with us. A top story this hour, Iran is blaming Europe's inaction for Washington's withdrawal from the nuclear deal and its violation of the landmark international accord. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman made the comment during a weekly presser. Said Khatibzadeh said that the European signatories to the Iran deal were passive onlookers of Washington's violations on audacities. Khatibzadeh underlined the signatories must reassure Tehran that such violations would never happen again. He also accused Germany of failing to implement a series of commitments under the deal. The Iran official was reacting to statements by outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. During her visit to Israel, she called on Iran to quickly return to the negotiations. Tehran has already made it clear it's reviewing technical details to make sure all parties will fully implement the agreement. Political commentator Tim Anderson says that Iran will further reduce its commitments if other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal continue to fail to fulfill their part of the obligations.
Of course, Russia and China were part of the deal, and they have a totally different position now. I mean, the deal when it was formulated a decade ago. The Europeans have demonstrated they don't have the political will to break from the US, even though they disagreed with the Trump position. Biden has effectively carried on the Trump idea of maximum pressure. It's simply about trying to leverage against Iran's role in the region entirely. We know that because they've tried to associate other issues like missile technology with the deal, basically. And there's really, Biden administration has shown that it can't really back down and say, okay, we'll go back to the original deal. They've never taken that position in the last 18 months of the Biden administration. So I think Iran just has to stick to its guns, more or less. It complied with the deal for the first 12 months or so. Then when there was no reciprocation, Iran said, okay, we're going to wind back our obligations under the deal.
Now let's take a look at neighboring countries. Vote counting is underway for the Sunday early parliamentary elections in Iraq. The Electoral Commission has put the voter turnout at 41%, lower than the last election in 2018. Some 25 million people were eligible to cast their ballots for the 329-seat legislature. Around 3,500 candidates are in the fray. This is Iraq's fifth parliamentary election since the ouster of former dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003. The Sunday vote was called a year earlier than it was scheduled in response to the 2019 street rallies over economic woes and high-level corruption. Correspondent Baghdad Wassam Bahrani joined us earlier with some details regarding the vote counting process following the elections in Iraq.
These are preliminary results that have been announced. 41%, which is, some would say that's a low turnout, and some would say that's a good turnout considering the circumstances that the country is facing, security threats and issues and the such. In any case, I think questions will be asked because not a lot is expected to change in Parliament. These are, according to party officials and candidates who received the results of the new electronic system. They received the results, a list of the results, so they have an idea as to how the results would have unfolded. And we're expecting an official announcement as to the exact turnout, and which is expected to remain at that number, even lower than 2018, where 44.5% had turned out. And we're also at around 3 p.m. expecting a general announcement of, you know, who won how many seats.
And of course, we're expecting a press conference for that. Now, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khatami has announced the arrest of a ranking leader of the Daesh terrorist group. Khatami said that Sami Jassim, the terrorist group's finance chief, was captured in a complex external operation by Iraqi intelligence forces. He did not specify the location. Jassim was also a deputy to Daesh's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was killed in a U.S. air raid in Syria in 2019. Daesh took over almost one-third of Iraq in an offensive that began in June 2014. The terrorist advance was blocked by the army and allied volunteer forces of the Popular Mobilization Units. Iraq announced victory over Daesh in December 2017. A huge fire has broken out at an oil facility in southern Lebanon following a reported blast. A thick column of black smoke can be seen billowing from a fuel storage tank in the Zahrani facility. Firefighters have rushed to the site located near the city of Sidon to prevent the blaze from spreading to other tanks. The army has also evacuated the area amid fears that a fire may cause explosions. The cause of the blaze is not clear yet, and that's happening as Lebanon is grappling with an acute fuel shortage. We'll have talked to our correspondent in Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, has some details regarding the fire at the fuel storage facility.
So what we know from about this tanker is that it contained gas oil for the Lebanese army. This was a storage tank. We have lost. The reason seems to be, this is just only preliminary, energy minister has said that there needs to be more investigations to know exactly the reason behind this. However, there was the workers were trying to move the gasoline from one tanker to the other because it was old, it was wearing out. And that probably was one of the reasons why things were as bad. Now, this is in a plant in South Lebanon, which is called the Deir Zahrani, one of the two major power plants in the country. And this tanker falls in that facility near that power plant. And that power plant, the two power plants actually, one in the south in Zahrani, the other one in the north in Deir Ahmad, they both were shut off completely last Saturday until the army provided some fuel in order for these two companies to give at least 2 hours of electricity.
Now, in other news, Israeli forces have destroyed a house belonging to a Palestinian family east of Tel Aviv that was located in Kfar Qassam village. The regime frequently demolishes Palestinian homes and structures under a variety of pretexts, including a lack of construction permits. Earlier this month, a UN report revealed nearly 100 Palestinians were displaced as a result of demolitions in the occupied Al-Quds in August alone. A total of 200 people have become homeless in the occupied territories this year. Palestinians and rights groups say that the demolitions aim to grab more land to expand their settlements, and all the Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Palestinian farmers and traders in the Gaza Strip have held a protest at Kerem Abu Salem crossing, demanding an end to what they call the suffocating closure by Israel. The crossing serves as the main gate connecting Gaza to the outside world. Ruba Shabat has more.
Kerem Abu Salem crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Kerem Abu Salem threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector. That is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Kerem Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Kerem Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also expressed the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that caused serious financial losses. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Now in Tunisia, President Kais Saied has approved the country's new government weeks after he fired the prime minister and suspended parliament. Saied confirmed the government named by Prime Minister Najla Boudin, who was appointed earlier this month. Her choices included several of the interim ministers that Saied had appointed during the 11-week period that he held executive power. Saied was under pressure to appoint a premier and new government amid criticism that his suspension of parliament on July 25th was a coup. On Sunday, thousands of people also marched in the capital Tunis to condemn his power grab. Five soldiers have been killed by suspected militants in Indian-controlled Kashmir as tensions running high in the disputed region amid a spate of civilian killings. An army spokesman said that the troopers were shot dead while on a search operation. Now, that happened near the line of control that separates the region from the Pakistani-administered side. And that's a day after Indian military detained some 500 residents following targeted killings of seven civilians, including two teachers. A group calling itself the Resistance Front has claimed responsibility. Tensions have been heightened in the Muslim-majority region since New Delhi revoked its semi-autonomy status and brought it under direct rule in 2019. New Delhi and Islamabad both claimed Kashmir in its entirety and fought two wars on the region since their independence in 1947. Our correspondent in Kashmir says that security has been beefed up across the region, particularly near the border areas.
There's also an info that one militant has also died, but nothing is clear so far because of the reason that the entire operation is happening in a dense forest, and it is getting very difficult even for security forces to reach. But yes, the security has been beefed up across the region, and all the outgoing points have been sealed, and the search operation is going on, and also a lot of security has been pumped in to check what's happening. According to the army officials, the militants have recently sneaked into the Kashmir side of a line of control, Indian side of the line of control, and they believe that they are heavily armed, and they are just checking the situation. So far, nothing is clear because it seems like an unstoppable firing going on from both sides, and it seems that the militants are still active. So the government official, I mean the army, is still waiting for the firing to subside and see what they can do. Even they have started using choppers and other drone activities to monitor where and all these militants can be hiding into the forest.
The United States saying it's held candid and professional talks with a Taliban delegation in Qatar. The U.S. State Department saying that the two sides discussed security and terrorism as well as human rights in Afghanistan, among other issues. The department added, however, that Washington will judge the Taliban on the basis of their actions, not words. According to the Afghan Acting Foreign Minister, representatives from the two countries also discussed opening a new page in bilateral relations. Amin Khan Muttaqi said that the Taliban delegation urged the U.S. to lift a ban on the country's central bank reserves. The group rose back to power in Afghanistan in August, almost two decades after it was ousted in a U.S.-led invasion. The Taliban's takeover happened amid a hasty withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Let's now take a look at Europe. A huge crowd has gathered in the Belgian capital, Brussels, demanding world leaders take tougher action to fight climate change. Many of the demonstrators accuse EU leaders of dithering over the crisis. Jerome Hughes has a report.
Tens of thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, this is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world. And I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are not seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we are going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, keep it in the ground. Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue.
That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially.
World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. In here. I'd better close the window and turn on the air conditioner. I'm heat intolerant. So this is the window and the air conditioner. So I was telling you that I'm heat intolerant, and guess what? Tomorrow I'm going to take a tour to Maranjab Desert, to one of the hottest regions of Iran in summer. If you could remember, we had been to Maranjab Desert once before. But our tomorrow's destination in Maranjab is its beautiful caravanserai. Stay with me. Maranjab Caravanserai is a caravanserai and a castle in the heart of the desert. This caravanserai is located beside Aran and Bidgol Salt Lake, north of Isfahan province. This caravanserai was built by the order of Shah Abbas Safavi in 983 Solar Hijri. This caravanserai, with an area of about 3,500 square meters, has 29 rooms. Maranjab Caravanserai is on the Silk Road and was used as a link road between Khorasan and Isfahan provinces. The roof of this caravanserai is built like watchtowers and used to have 500 armed forces who had the duty to provide the security of merchants and goods which used to be passed from China to Europe and vice versa. Maranjab Caravanserai also has a freshwater canal. I'm driving to Maranjab Caravanserai. It's desert and desert as far as the eye could see. To be honest, I love the scenery. It makes me so calm. Around the road, there are different types of desert plants, including tamarisk, alhegi, I don't know the name of the rest. They look very strange to me. So here we arrived, and this is Maranjab Caravanserai. Magnificent! It's made of bricks, which is usually used as a construction material in dry regions. I am now in a corridor. On my left, there is a twisty staircase which reaches the roof. I want to go up
in order to watch the sunset. And now I am in the big, beautiful yard of Maranjab Caravansarai. At the center of the yard, there are benches and tables so that visitors can watch the beautiful starry sky of the desert at night. Around the yard, there are chambers for rent. These rooms are well furnished. Each room is separated from the yard's ground level by two stairs. I have rented the room on my right for a night. Oh, how beautiful it is. The ceiling is dome-like. There are niches on the walls, which remind me of my grandma's old house. Very beautiful. I'm sure I would have a great night here in this caravansarai. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Economic divide.
It is a known fact that Israel has influence in many industries in the world, in particular when it comes to the financial world. But to what extent does it have influence in that industry? Hi, I'm Kavit Atley. This edition of Economic Divide, we will look at Israeli control in financial sectors like payment systems, and in particular, its penetration in the U.S. financial system. Coming up in today's program, Israeli influence over the United States. Does it overlap into U.S.'s financial system, like the Fed or Wall Street? We'll take a close look at Fortune 500 companies like J.P. Morgan Chase. How did it and others like it become the largest banks in the U.S.? Then we're going to take a look at a recent deal that occurred between PayPal and the ADL. Partnership to fight extremism and hate to the financial industry, but does PayPal have ulterior motives, like going after Israeli critics? And then finally, we'll take a look at two technologies that are present in the financial system, namely fintech and blockchain. Why are there so many startups and investments in Israel in this technology, and why the concentration on payment systems? Recently, there was a team up of two entities that made news, and that relates to how Israeli companies are taking control or influencing, at a minimum, financial tools, in this case, payment system. PayPal Holdings Incorporated, in partnership with ADL, stands for the Anti-Defamation League, announced a new partnership initiative to fight extremism and hate through the financial industry. Now, Israel's control of these types of payment systems, especially in the digital money area, has led to it to target whom it sees as its adversaries, whether in business or politics, like Hamas or Iran.
Anti-Defamation League is announcing a new partnership with PayPal to defund hate groups.
the dollar swapping firm PayPal announced a new initiative to track and disrupt payment activity from extremist and hate groups. They would be aided in this effort, they said, by the Anti-Defamation League and a coalition of partner organizations.
From the sounds of it, it appears to be a good initiative, right? But think again. PayPal partnering with ADL to fight extremism and to protect marginalized communities is not all that it appears to be. To combat criminal activity or zoom in on transactions that fund human trafficking or illicit smuggling, like drug smuggling, are all good initiatives. Problem is when the issue takes a political turn. ADL is zooming in on extremists or hate groups, and herein lies the problem. To begin with, hate groups are not illegal. Furthermore, what is the definition that the ADL uses to define this? Well, it doesn't take much investigation to figure this out. ADL, which stands for the Anti-Defamation League, is a leading anti-hate organization that was founded in 1913 in response to an escalating climate of anti-Semitism and bigotry.
ADL, as we've talked about on your show before, is the oldest anti-hate group in the country. And we've been focused on studying extremist individuals, organizations, and movements literally for decades. And our experts in our Center on Extremism are some of the best analysts in the U.S. on understanding groups across the ideological spectrum.
To that end, it serves another entity, Israel. The ADL, therefore, can go after hate groups that don't endorse or agree with Israeli policies, like the Hamas resistance groups or Hezbollah. Can even go further and target countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran or other countries that condemn Israeli violation of Palestinians. ADL may even go as far as proposing PayPal to shut down social media accounts of users who engage in what ADL defines as hate and extremism.
Well, joining us now to discuss this further is Rodney Martin. He's a political activist, a current affairs analyst. He's also a historian and researcher. Martin is the chairman of the American Nationalist Association. He also hosts a regular radio podcast by the name of World View Conversations. Rodney is also a former U.S. congressional staffer and political candidate, as well as having served in local and state government. Rodney, welcome. Recently, there's this partnership that was announced between PayPal Holdings Incorporated and ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. This partnership initiative to have as its goal fighting extremism and hate through the financial industry. What are your thoughts on this in terms of the way that this partnership has been announced and the goal that it has in front of it?
Well, absolutely, and that's been taken. It first started taking place on the social media platforms, particularly Facebook. And then it spread now into the PayPal, who won't allow PayPal transactions if they disagree with a person's political views. And it's interesting, they have a very subjective view of extremism. You do not see PayPal, Facebook, and social media, and these giants, censoring Israeli and Jewish extremism, particularly those that praise the murder of Palestinian and Arab women and children, that advocate pro-war policies and seek to essentially manipulate the American political system, society, and culture, that the manipulation of financial markets and the media has become very easy, as well as censorship, because you now have people who on one hand will decry censorship if they say something versus, say, a Republican versus the Democratic Party. But if somebody says something critical of Israel, those same people that are calling for censorship wants those people censored. So it's really a schizophrenic system that has developed in the United States as a result of outside influences by a very, very small minority. Powerful, but powerful.
Okay, well, let's get the thoughts of Allison Weir and introduce her. Allison Weir is the director or the executive director of Americans New, a nonprofit organization that focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and also the foreign policy of the United States regarding West Asia. Allison, welcome. What are your thoughts on this PayPal and ADL partnership? In some sense, doesn't this pave the way for them to go after what, for example, ADL sees that is suiting its purpose of what constitutes extremism, hate,
or whatever it deems to be anti-Israeli, which includes what's posted on social media outlets like Facebook?
I think there's no doubt that this type of thing is used by Israel all the time to target people it dislikes and to take down websites it doesn't want that contains information they dislike. I think that's very clear. The Anti-Defamation League, I feel, is one of the real problems in the United States because this has a very benign reputation. I used to think of it as a good organization because most of us are against defamation, against bigotry, against any kind of unfair racial profiling or prejudice. But it turns out that the Anti-Defamation League is really very largely focused on advocating for Israel. These exaggerated views of Jewish culpability, because all Jewish Americans are not guilty of that. We're talking about individuals.
It's time now for our InfoNews section, where we pick topics old and new that we find important or don't get enough media attention or exposure. Now, what is going on with energy resources? China, this is a topic that we thought was important, has actually ordered energy firms to secure winter fuel supplies, and this is the part that's interesting, at all costs. That means to do whatever it takes to secure fuel supplies. Now, that's going to put further pressure on the price of gas that's paid already by struggling UK energy suppliers, as an example, which is already grappling with power cuts. Now, let's follow this up with that UK energy crisis, which is on the cusp of that, if it's not already, of mammoth proportions. People there may experience an 80% increase in their gas bills. And it's happened already. Energy firm Bulb under fire for monthly bill rises of up to 80%. Now keep in mind that the UK is already plagued by fuel poverty that leads to thousands of deaths during the harsh, cold winter season. Next up, climate crisis. Apple and Disney, if you can believe it, are among companies that are backing groups against the U.S. climate bill. That's right. Amazon and Microsoft are supporting groups fighting legislation to fight climate change. This is despite promises to combat the climate crisis. And of course, as you can see there, that's the budget allocated for that $3.35 trillion. Finally, the chip crisis is not going away, and in particular this for car chips. And what's happened is that it's such a serious problem that car manufacturing in Britain actually fell by 27%. And then Mercedes-Benz also is experiencing problems, warning against possible delay in delivering new cars by at least 1 year.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section where we take a deep look into the topic at hand. Now we're going to take a look at a technology called blockchain and why Israel is a hotspot for that. Now in the past few years, Israel, driven by its military complex and its military industry, has become a hub for startups and innovation, especially with the two technologies that I mentioned, the blockchain and fintech. Now blockchain, in case you don't know, is the same technology that is behind the digital currency Bitcoin. Do you see the money connection? You're going to find out why I'm mentioning that in a few minutes. Let's move on to another reason for Israeli companies to want to expand in this field. Israeli blockchain companies are after what's called faster settlement times and larger transaction sizes of digital assets. Okay, that's very important. Moving on to another reason for its appeal, by establishing a decentralized ledger like for Bitcoin, blockchain technology could facilitate faster payments and larger transaction sizes of digital assets. Okay, so obviously you can see the appeal there.
Things that we do as a central bank, our role in the payments industry, the group that I lead, payments department, include establishing policy, kind of long-term policy for the payments landscape in the country, overseeing payment systems, operating payment systems, which are two very different things. We'll get into that in a minute. The payment systems that we operate are RTGS and the National Check Clearinghouse, as well as influencing and partnering with other government agencies and the operations part of the central bank to convert ourselves into a catalyst for adopting digital payments, because as government and as a central bank, we are able to influence consumer behavior deeply. So we take that role seriously as well.
Now, taking a look at fintech, it refers to the integration of technology into offerings by financial services companies. But this is what's important. Fintech expansion by Israel has lured foreign banks to Israel. So you can see that that is paying off again, looking at the money connection.
Once that customer walked into the shoe store and tried to make a payment with the card, her connection with her bank is with the bank that issued her credit card. The store's connection is with the acquirer that processes the card transactions for the store, but they need to connect. They connect by sending each other data messages, transaction authorization requests, clearing, and then ultimately they also settle funds between them. It is that connection between the payment service providers, this yellow arrow in the middle, which actually comprises the payment system.
And all of this interest for Israeli companies and startups, well, it shows how Israel has influence over the financial payment system when it comes to, for example, banks. Now, when you take a look at that, just what I pointed out, this poses this question. Doesn't this give Israel more control or influence over these large financial groups? That is the key question, which obviously is the underlying reason behind Israel's penetration into this market. Occupy Wall Street, OWS. It was an event that took place 10 years ago. Back then, hundreds of protesters took over Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. They marched toward the financial district and voiced their anger at Wall Street firms and hedge funds that they controlled the U.S.
What kind of power?
People power!
Wall Street, it crashes, and people starve, people lose their jobs, things like that. We're very angry at Wall Street. It's part of capitalism, American capitalism especially. That's why we're here today at Wall Street.
The movement would last 59 days, but its ripple effects are still being felt. However, there was another side to the story. The protesters were also angry at the CEOs of some of these conglomerates.
Patricia McAllister, I'm here representing myself, but I do work for the Los Angeles Unified School District. And I think that the Zionist Jews who are running these big banks in our Federal Reserve, which is not run by the federal government, they need to be run out of this country.
These anti-Israeli sentiments were views held by the American and general public for a very long time. Their anger was directed not only at the firms, but also the CEOs. Here are some examples. The general view is that these Wall Street firms and their CEOs, and their greed in particular, were blamed for inequality and political corruption. They were also blasted for the special attention that they received during the 2008 financial crisis. The too big to fail was the government term used for bailing out some of these firms along with their CEOs.
U.S. influence, or by some accounts, control over the U.S., is not new news. By Israel, that is. But how does Israel exert control over the U.S.? And more importantly, why does the U.S. allow this to happen? Let's take the U.S. Central Bank or the Fed as an example. New York Federal Reserve System is the name of the central bank of the U.S. It plays a leadership role in monetary policy,
financial supervision and the payments system of the U.S. By definition, control is exercised only by a board of governors, a member of which is a public servant, as they call it, that's appointed to his or her position by the President of the United States and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Well, let's take a look at the appointments of high-ranking officials at the Fed, current and past. You have the current New York Fed Chair, Janet Yellen. You have Ben Bernanke, William Dudley, and Lee Bollinger. They all held top positions at the Fed, from the chairman to vice chairman. All right, rejoining us in this segment is Rodney Martin, and we also have Allison Weir, Executive Director of If Americans Knew, rejoining us. Rodney, my last question goes to you here. There's a perception about the Fed that is dominated and controlled, influenced somehow by Israel. Some have even gone as far as saying that the money power that rules the world today, in another respect, is centered at the hands of a few individuals. Are there any truths to these?
Well, there is a probably a more pertinent source, and that came from none other than Meyer Rothschild, who said, "Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes the laws." So I would, there you have it in and of itself. And of course, the Rothschilds have been a very powerful Jewish banking family for centuries. And as far as a Federal Reserve, one need only look at three of the immediate past Federal Reserve chairmen, all of which shared something in common with Meyer Rothschild. And this has created some significant problems within society, particularly in minority communities in the United States, as more and more minorities fall more and more prey to very, very predatory banking practices.
Okay. Well, Allison, one of the things that has always been said and has become obvious is how Israel influences U.S. officials up to the top positions, and that is the U.S. presidents. Again, for Israel to influence decision-making policies by the U.S. president. Even U.S. presidential candidates, when they're running, they need to woo the Israeli vote. Is it a fact that Israel, therefore, can influence the U.S., the White House, or the U.S. president's decision-making?
Well, again, this is a significant fact, but it's a little bit, it's certainly much more nuanced than people might think. There is, I have written about the Israel lobby quite a bit because my focus is on Israel-Palestine, and it's very important to know what's driving U.S. policies. And I have consistently found that it is the Israel lobby that has driven our policies from the very beginning. And the Israel lobby largely consists of Jewish individuals and organizations. It also consists of others, but I'd say that's the group that dominates the Israel lobby.
Okay, we appreciate that. That is Allison Weather, Executive Director of If Americans Knew. Well, the point that Allison made there about the Israeli lobby is very significant. The Israeli lobby that she's talking about is very dominant, and what she is referring to there is AIPAC. And in particular, what is prevalent there is that U.S. lawmakers have to actually pledge their allegiance to Israel with conditions attached, as you're about to say. Next up, a look at one of the most influential families in the world, namely the Rothschilds. They have been behind many investments during their time, which is a window into how they exerted their power and influence in different business sectors. But what better way to tell you about this family than to introduce our new addition to the ED family, Matthew.
Our focus here is a family called the Rothschilds, a familiar name to many people. They are a wealthy family originally from Germany. They have been accused of secretly controlling the world economy and profiting from wars. The Rothschilds were the dominant power in European investment banking, which controlled 50% of the world's wealth. In 1823, it was reported that they took control over the financial operations of the Catholic Church worldwide. Through J.P. Morgan, among others, the Rothschilds took control of the banking industry in New York and therefore the U.S. Some of the other investments are Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company, Edward Harriman Railroad Empire, and Andrew Carnegie's Steel Empire. Rothschild's banks were also known to finance railway systems around the world. They financed the construction of the Suez Canal in Egypt, and they provided the capital for De Beers in 1888, which is the largest diamond mining company in the world. In 1987, Edmond de Rothschild created the World Conservation Bank to gain control of land in third world countries. The bank assumes the debts of these countries in exchange for real estate that is conveyed to the bank. In 1913, the Rothschilds established their last and current central bank in America, the Federal Reserve Bank. This independent bank regulates and controls America's money supply and monetary policies. Talking about central banks, it's interesting to note here that by 2001, only seven nations in the world, including China, Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea, Sudan, Cuba, and Libya, did not have Rothschild-controlled central banks. By 1995, the Rothschilds controlled an estimated 80% of the world's uranium reserves, thereby giving the family a monopoly over the nuclear power. The modern-day Rothschilds family, however, is said not to have the same wealth and influence as before. One reason is that they have produced hundreds of descendants and there is no longer any centralized family wealth. However, they are known as the wealthiest family in history to have a collective net worth of $400 billion as of 2021. Please send us your comments. We do appreciate them.
The partnership between ADL and PayPal. Yes, there are good incentives there. I mean, ADL claims it is after cutting off the hands, the financial hands of extremist groups and hate, at least in their eyes. That is a good thing, but here's where the double standard is. If that is our aim, then what about the money that Israel has sent to assassins who have assassinated people in other countries, like in multiple cases of Iranian nuclear scientists? Or what about money that is sent to Israel from the U.S. to expand settlement activities, which the U.S. classifies as charity money sent to Israel? Now, these are acts that are clearly against international law. Where's PayPal and ADL there? Something to think about, isn't it? That is for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions or comments are always welcome. From me, Kavitafi, and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.